From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a doctor's office where a retired professor of epidemiology was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. After consulting with two oncologists and a surgeon, he was offered conflicting recommendations, and some of those recommendations were surprising to him. Now, as an epidemiologist, he understood his prognosis. He had a logical analysis of the situation, but he found that having more information seemed to overwhelm him, and he felt lost. The patient, we'll call Mr. Grayson, asked his family physician, "What would you do if you were me?" And the doctor said, "Well, I might have different values and preferences than you do, so let's focus on what's most important to you." And that approach seems to put the patient and their values first, right? But an expert in mindfulness and medicine argues that maybe that's not the best method of communicating with patients. He says it assumes that Mr. Grayson's values are static and can't be changed by a dialogue with his doctor and his family. By having that dialogue, Mr. Grayson could become open to new ideas that could change his treatment plan. And ultimately, that's what happened. Mr. Grayson is a pseudonym of a real patient profiled by Dr. Ronald Epstein, a professor of family medicine, psychiatry, and oncology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Ron's an expert in communication in medical settings. He's going to present research on doctor-patient communication at an upcoming lecture at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. He's joining me in studio this hour for a preview of that talk and to talk about these related issues that seem to happen, well, they really happen to everybody. We all talk to our doctors at some point. We all want more time with our doctors, and how we communicate in those settings is so important. So great to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Always great to have you. And Dr. Rob Horowitz is here. Rob is Chief of Palliative Care in the Department of Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. He is an associate professor of medicine and pediatrics, and by the way, the distinguished Gosnell professor in palliative care there. Great to have you, Rob. Thanks for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Ron has a long set of titles as well, including he directs the Center for Communication and Disparities Research, which is what, by the way?
Well, we study how patients and doctors communicate and how to improve it. And also, we study how communication sometimes is affected by patients' age, gender, race, ethnicity.
There's a lot to talk about, and the event that we're talking about is 2 weeks from tonight. That is Tuesday, April 17th at 7 p.m. at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. That event is free. You got to register, raom.org. This seems to relate to everybody. I was going to ask who you think would be an ideal audience, but doctors, patients, anyone who may eventually have a doctor for any reason.
And anyone who may eventually get sick.
Yes, exactly. So I want to start with just the anecdote that we kind of led with here with Mr. Grayson and understanding that question of, well, what would you do? Doctors get asked that all the time, don't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's a difficult question because it means that people are searching for an answer, and the answer may not always be so clear.
When it comes to the question, I want to ask Ron and Rob the same one here. What's the best way for doctors to handle a what would you do?
I think the first part is to help patients understand the kind of uncertainty that surrounds the information that we give. So I take care of a lot of seriously ill patients like Rob, and often patients say that they want to know, for example, how long they're going to live, how well they're going to live, and where they'll be able to spend their last days. And those are difficult questions to answer.
So when it comes down to that, you know, if you were in my shoes, what would you do? Is it appropriate for a doctor to answer as forthrightly as possible? Or is it sometimes appropriate to say, you know, look, we all have different preferences and I want to understand your values?
I think a combination. So, you know, when patients ask what I would do, there are two problems with that. One is, even though I've taken care of a lot of sick patients, it's difficult to fully imagine myself in someone else's shoes. I can do a pretty good job of that, but it's really hard when a serious illness is really staring you in the face as opposed to when you have some distance from it. So that's the first issue. So, and the second is that, as you said, everyone's values are different. So what I would say, what I often will say is, I'll tell you that. I'll tell you what I would do, but first I want to understand your values. So I actually do both and. And I'll say, well, I imagine that if I were in this situation, I might do X, but other people might do differently, and this is why they might.
Okay. Rob, what about you in that question? What would you do?
Yeah, I buy that. I know that question is often informed by a sense of connection with me. If I've nurtured a meaningful relationship with my patient, often the patient and the family will look to me as a fellow human, as a fellow mortal who may not have their exact experience, but knows what it is to experience uncertainty and grief and fear. And so couching it, as Ron is saying, in my unique worldview and culture and values is really important. As a stepping stone, I do get this sense oftentimes that patients appreciate hearing the truth from us with humility.
I just got done reading a long piece in The New Yorker about Jahi McMath, who is a girl who was declared brain dead in California following surgery in 2013. She was 13 years old. She had tonsils removed, and obviously things went wrong. And her family did not accept that she was, you know, that she was dead, that she was legally dead. And it became a national story in which the family endured a lot of sort of written abuse. And they kept saying, look, we don't care that the medical world is telling us this is clinically death, that this is that Jahi is not alive anymore or will never be able to function cognitively anymore, that Jahi is still going through things like menstrual cycles and the heart is still beating and there's a lot happening here, that for us that's enough. And I know we jumped right to a big question, Rob, but when it comes to the what would you do, this was a case that became a national story of a family saying, I don't even want you to define death for me, that some of us wouldn't want to suffer and would want to die as painlessly as possible without suffering and at home. Some want to be alive for whatever that means as long as we possibly can. And I guess I want to start by asking you, Rob, is you find that valid? Is that okay?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, if I may point out another example that comes to mind as you're talking about it, Stephen Jay Gould, some years ago, a wonderful writer, biologist, was diagnosed with mesothelioma, awful lung disease. And he wrote a piece, what was it, Ron? The median is not the message, something like that, looking at the statistics. And he also looked at the curve and said, you know, there's a long skew to the right. Some people live a lot longer than the 8-month median. I'm going to live for that. Not everyone would. I think our imperative is to share the information we have as tailored as possible to the needs and the culture and the values of the patient and the family we're talking with, and hear what matters to them. And for some, it does matter the fact that this body is alive and warm, even though we're saying dead. And for others, having a quality of life where I can, as I'm looking you in the eye right now, that's important to me. That's how I define quality. Not everybody agrees with that, and we need to engage in conversation where there will be difference.
And I think, Ron, probably in a case where someone may have reached a state of what we would call sort of medical death or whatever the actual technical term is, it's important to be honest with families about possibility, but then still, I guess, agency and autonomy and decision-making has to be theirs. And sometimes that whole question on, even if you feel like they're doing something that is not what you at all would you would do, and they don't ask you. I mean, it's one thing to say, what would you do as my doctor? It's another for them to make decisions that you think are not the right decisions. Is it appropriate at certain times to intervene and say, look, I think this is the wrong choice?
You're asking good questions. I do. I do think it's important to be transparent about the values that I'm bringing to a situation, but to do it with a sense of humility. I'm just thinking about predictions, for example. I have a good friend, a childhood friend, who was diagnosed with kidney cancer. He was presented with the treatment options and a likely prognosis, and he wanted to know all the information. And he was told most people with this disease live 4 to 6 months, and these are the treatment choices. None of the treatment choices were particularly effective, and most of them had some pretty bad side effects. So he decided to actually go without, to do nothing. It's nearly 2 years now, and I'm going to visit him next month. He lives in Boston. So here's a situation in which, you know, all the doctors with the best knowledge that we had made the best estimate of what possibly would happen, both in terms of quality and quantity of life. He's weaker. He doesn't go out of the house very much, but clearly is still enjoying life. And his and has lived significantly longer than. So I think when we present information, it's important to present what's possible, what's likely, and to help people wrestle with that uncertainty. And I think more than even a bad prognosis, an uncertain prognosis is more difficult for people to assimilate. You know, if you knew that, you know, 3 months from next Tuesday your life would end, you might be able to plan or do something. But we can't do that. And so I think, you know, having had a lot of those experiences of being wrong, of thinking, well, or thinking about that this person may be not average in a variety of ways, really invites a sense of humility and a sense of dialogue as opposed to a sense of certainty.
2 weeks from tonight, 7 p.m., Tuesday, April 17th, it's the annual lecture, the Lion Daughters Lecture at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. Registration is free online, raom.org. What do you want the audience to take out of that event?
I want them to take out of the event questions that they can bring to their doctor if they're patients, and if they're health professionals, the kind of dialogue that really involves patients as people. In talking about these important issues, and that our role isn't just simply giving information, that it's really an exchange of information.
Listeners, if you have questions or comments, these are two of the best authorities anywhere on helping us understand the way we communicate with our doctors. And we've all felt the pressure of not having a lot of time. I speak to my mother often about this, and you know, she'll say, well, I didn't ask that because, you know, I didn't want to bother. Or, you know, the doctor seemed rushed, so I didn't. I'd say, Mom, you can't do this. But I understand that frustration. I've been there myself. If you've got questions or comments about communication with our doctors, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Rob wants to know, asking, by the way, on behalf of his mother who's in the hospital, the doctors aren't around a lot in the hospital, according to a nurse who worked with her. Why can't they visit patients more often, first of all?
Wow. I wish they did as well. Too often, we're called in as palliative care specialists to have conversations because the big conversation hasn't happened. Maybe the conversation with your mom hasn't transpired yet. The physicians are overwrought with busyness. They're pulled in many directions. There's no doubt about it. And being willing and available to sit down and have the detailed conversation requires a commitment of time. It requires a commitment to getting to the truth. It requires a willingness to tolerate uncomfortable emotion and to, I think, humbly admit to our uncertainty, even in the realm of such science.
Okay, Ron?
I think in addition to that, it's really the choices we make about what we choose to hear and what we choose to ask. So when I'm with a patient who's seriously ill, I'll ask a question like, what's the worst part of this? Or what's most important for us to talk about right now? And that sets the stage for just, in a way, getting through some of the more superficial things that we could talk about. And my ability to guess what's most important to a given patient is not all that great. And so I have to ask.
What's an example?
A common one, which is unfortunate and surprising, is I'll talk with someone who's at the end of their life and say, what are you most worried about? And they'll talk about financial issues. They'll talk about leaving their families impoverished because of medical bills but often that comes out, and you'd think that if someone were at the end of their life that, for example, their own pain might be more prominent or their own uncertainty. So that's just one example. I find that a lot of patients aren't afraid of death, but they're afraid of the unknowns of dying. And patients are afraid to ask, what's dying like? And clearly it's something that I haven't experienced personally, but I can say, having watched people and having taken care of people, this is what's likely to happen, and this is what we can do about it. And so those are questions that frequently aren't asked, and patients then keep them to themselves, and I think that in and of itself causes more suffering.
If they bring up finances, I'm trying to inhabit the mind of friends of mine who are doctors who might think, look, that's not something I can help you with. But is there an appropriate response for a doctor who says, wow, this is the number one stressor for you right now? Yeah. I'm not a financial expert, but is there something you can do or say at that moment?
Yeah. First of all, I'll say, does your family know this? Okay. So sometimes I can help facilitate a discussion between the patient and their family. And sometimes it's just a simple misunderstanding. Patients might not know that their very expensive treatments actually are covered by insurance. Mm-hmm. And that, so sometimes it's, and then there are also social workers and there are financial counselors. There are people actually who can help patients. And I would just direct them towards that.
And Rob, you're nodding over there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we would like to be all things to our patients and sometimes strive to, but part of this humility we're both talking about is saying, I have an expert here in finance or logistics or placement who can help you.
Mm-hmm. We have our phones filled up now, and let me just get the back half of Rob's question. He followed up asking about on behalf of his mother who's in the hospital, says sometimes doctors get so engrossed in the diagnosis that they don't take into account how the patient feels when it comes to pain or emotion. How can they become more mindful of that?
Well, I see diagnosis as more than just the name of the disease. So when I'm with a patient, I'm not only diagnosing the name of the disease, but also their existential state. Their place in their family, what's worrying them. And all of that, for me, goes into a more total sense of understanding the patient as a person. And I think all too often in medical training, we learn to label and categorize things and not see people's individual needs and circumstances. So that's something that I try to teach students and residents that I work with and also colleagues that just... And it doesn't necessarily take a lot of time. So, I mean, I'm on clinical service in the hospital now. And typically when I meet a new patient, I'll ask them where they live, what kind of work they do or did, who are relevant family that are nearby. And that takes about a minute or two. But at least I get a sense, some picture of who this is as a person and not just someone with leukemia or heart failure or having had a liver transplant.
And by the way, before I get to your phone calls, I know you speak to colleagues, you work on bridging these gaps and helping them communicate better. What do your colleagues say when you tell them to kind of ask these certain questions and take these approaches? Do they bristle a little bit or are they open to it?
I think some of my colleagues are a little scared because they don't quite know what to do with the answers. And also it exposes their own sense of vulnerability. So as part of training people to communicate better, it's not just the words you say, but how you take in, how you listen, how you can be present with someone who's telling you something that perhaps you don't want to hear, or perhaps that makes you feel helpless.
Let me get Patrick in Penfield first up on the phone. Go ahead, Patrick.
Yes, I'm a patient, and I've got a conflicted issue. Sometimes my doctor, and it is Dr. Epstein, will give me options. And what I want to know sometimes is what he thinks. An opinion, subjective, because I trust them. And I sense a hesitation sometimes in that the doctor wants to give me the facts, here's the options, and you can choose. And I don't know if maybe I'm the only one that's feeling conflicted by that, but sometimes I trust my MD, and I want to know what he thinks. And maybe it's not fair to ask, what would you do in this situation, but that's where I'm at. So I wonder if Dr. Epstein could elaborate on that.
When you ask patients what are the most difficult decisions they make in the medical context, it's not which treatment to choose, but which person to trust. And I think that's really important because even though, you know, technically speaking, patients have a right to be fully informed about their illness and treatment, for anyone to be fully informed would take hours and hours of explanation, right? Sometimes
sure.
Illness isn't very straightforward. And so what I try to do is provide patients with enough information about the relative advantages and disadvantages of each option, and then say, is there anything more that I need, that you need in terms of help of which one to choose? And if they say, which would you recommend? I'll be very forthright and I'll say, gee, you know, I think for you, knowing you, and I do primary care as well as palliative care, so I know many of my patients quite well. I'll say, well, you know, knowing you and knowing your values and knowing what your goals are, that this probably makes the most sense.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely true. So we spend a fair amount of time with colleagues and trainees who are struggling with this conversation, who have the notion, partly deeply ingrained over the last while, that we need to honor patient autonomy, which is interpreted as meaning we offer sometimes a neutral body of information, a menu to choose from. And in fact, patients and families are hungry for guidance from us as experts who have enough experience to help integrate both the medical situation and who the patient is and offer a recommendation. But offering a recommendation feels like a stretch to many.
Patrick, thanks for the phone call. We've got lines filled up, a lot of great emails and questions and comments coming in as we talk about patient-doctor communication. You should know, by the way, I didn't mention Dr. Epstein's book. Ron's book is Attending, which came out when, by the way?
Oh, a little over a year ago.
Just an outstanding book that I think is very helpful and you should keep in mind in case you want to learn more. You're thinking about your family members. You think about yourself. The book is Attending. And the event, the Lion Daughters Annual Lecture, is coming up 2 weeks from tonight. That's Tuesday, April 17th at 7 p.m. at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. Registration is free at raom.org. So Ron, one of our guests here, also Dr. Rob Horowitz is here, who is Chief of Palliative Care and at the University of Rochester Medical Center, among many other titles. So they are here offering their thoughts on how we can all do better with this. And let me grab another phone call. This is Rick in Rochester next. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
I have two things. One, I believe fully from personal experience that Eastern medicine needs to be integrated with Western medicine. I do understand as well that docs have not been trained to go with the long conversation with the patients, but I would ask the docs present, have you ever suggested a nurse advocate who would be the person to take them that length?
Thanks very much, Rick. Let's take the second one first. Nurse advocates there.
I'm not quite sure what a nurse advocate is. I'm sorry for my ignorance.
Maybe a patient advocate?
Patient advocate, yeah. It seemed like there are two things there. One is alternatives to what traditional medicine can offer. I'll just give a bit of personal history. I studied Chinese medicine before I went to medical school and studied acupuncture and did practice for a little while. And so I have an understanding of the merits of thinking more broadly about what constitutes healthcare, and not feeling that we have the market cornered just by offering Western medicine. So I think that's important.
Okay.
And the second thing, I think, is just that patients need to be offered those options, and increasingly are, actually.
I'm just curious to know, though, that given the lack of actual clinical study that benefits, take homeopathy. You know, I have no doubt that placebo is a powerful thing, and I wish we could harness it as much as we want at will. But homeopathy isn't something that has a whole lot of clinical study that shows any real benefit. And what do you say to a patient who says to you, look, I want wolfsbane, I want this, and you know, they're adamant about it. Doctor, what do you think? And does that happen?
Right. I don't know if you want to take this.
Yeah, all the time.
Okay.
And so I feel committed to doing the best I can to vet the question, ready at any moment to say, I just don't know about this, and to seek some guidance, further guidance. I can tell you that this community is hipper than some, at least, in considering complementary approaches. And there are integrative therapists available at UR and elsewhere. But I can talk with conviction about the things I know well. I can talk with trepidation about those I have good reason to believe might be harmful. And on others, I will end up being a supportive presence and supporting my patient to pursue something I don't have much evidence about. And I think I speak for many colleagues in that, Rick.
Okay. This is from another listener who says, I wonder what if could ask the physicians, what is their advice for helping patients incentivize their specialists to speak with each other and to convince our primary care doctors to talk to specialists and coordinate our care? This is especially frustrating in the case of chronic conditions such as orthopedic concerns.
Oh boy, isn't it? So this coordinated care, it's a major problem, admittedly so. I'm talking now from both inpatient and outpatient side, Ron now being on the inpatient palliative care service. One of the reasons we end up being called oftentimes is because so many well-meaning clinicians are serially entering that room, seeing a patient, sharing some information, some of which is captured, some of which isn't, never fully integrated. And the value of a team meeting where all the players, and including the family members, sit down with the patient to talk about what's going on, that's invaluable. And it's done too infrequently, for sure.
Is there a way to get that to change?
That's a systems issue. I'd like to think so. We certainly talk about it a fair amount. We see all the time how much time ultimately it saves, but in the moment it feels like it might detract from doing other duties. And so there is, believe it, there is conversation about this at the highest levels. How this will change, I'm certainly hopeful.
Okay. Here is from Deb, who says, when I was 48 years old, we discovered I had breast cancer. Of course, I was scared to death. When I went in to see the surgeon for the first time, a surgeon who's no longer in Rochester, she walked in, took one look at me on her way to wash her hands, and said over her shoulder, "You're not going to die from this, you know." And I burst into tears. And then she turned around and said she would stay with me as long as I needed to answer all of my questions. And then we were done 45 minutes later, and she gave me her home number and said, "You will probably have some more questions tonight when you get home and start thinking about it. Here's my cell. Call me." She was right, I did, and we did call her that night, and she answered the phone and then proceeded to answer my questions. She instilled in me such confidence that I believed not only in her abilities, but in my ability to heal and survive. 1 year later, on the anniversary of my mastectomy, she came to church with me. We did a dialogue sermon about healing. I wanted my spiritual support team to meet my medical support team. It was unforgettable. If that, she says, so Deb is saying it was sacred for her, and that she went from that one moment of sort of a, what sounded like a flippant comment, "You're not going to die from this, you know," to all of a sudden realizing, this is someone who is going to be there for me and is opening that up. And I wonder what you both think about that kind of communication.
I want that, doctor.
Right.
And I hope we clinicians, physicians, nurses, and others really carry the spirit of that approach. The message not being we are information gatherers and disseminators, but we are with you. We're companions.
But is that realistic, by the way, Rob?
I think it is. I don't know that we can have our panel of 2,000. I'm just talking with Ron about this today, 2,000 primary care patients. I'm not sure we can do that fully and well for all 2,000 of those all the time. I think we can do that some, and I think we can make the commitment to do that. Some of the me being there really does mean entrusting my team to manage when I can't.
What I want to add to that is that it's not only sharing good news, but also sometimes when you're sharing bad news, to take that same attitude. So let's say it wasn't someone with early breast cancer, but someone with advanced breast cancer. The message that I'll be with you every step of the way is the thing that the patient needs to hear the most. That not answering every single question today, because that's impossible, but that promise of never abandoning the patient.
And here's the other side of this. This is from Elizabeth. She says, "I love this discussion, and these doctors sound like amazing mentors for any healthcare specialist. I recently had a horrible experience with my doctor where she joked about being a spoiler for bad news about my baby in the womb. I was mortified and seriously concerned that she practices medicine. And what should I do in this situation? Should I tell her how insensitive she was so I can try to have that not happen to other patients? Should I ignore it? I'm looking for a new doctor, but it's hard to find one who values relationships. I'm a social worker by trade. I have high expectations for how dignified I am treated and my values. And thank you for this show, by the way." She says, "Please train all the students you can." So thank you, Elizabeth, for that. I know the doctors here appreciate that. Let's start with her first question. What should she do with this doctor who she felt offended her view of an ethical conversation?
So that's heart-aching, shall
yeah.
I?
Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
You know, what strikes me now, here's me in my administrative head as a boss. I want to know about that. I would like, as a physician, to hear from my patient when I cross them, and I have. Not by intent, not by design, but I have certainly upset people. I value when I hear that. I think it deepens our relationship. It's hard to do, though. But I would certainly encourage that. And if that does not yield a reasonable response, whatever that might be for Elizabeth in this case, as far as I'm concerned, that mandates reaching then above to whoever's employing that clinician, because this is information the clinician needs to hear. There will be other patients who could, if this is her practice, suffer at her hands. I think that's important to speak to.
Shortly after we got our electronic health record, or a few months afterwards, a patient who I'd known for years and years said to me at the beginning of a visit, you know, the last couple visits were different. You used to listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality was that this is a very complicated electronic health record system. I was learning it, and I was clearly occupying the majority of my awareness. And just that statement was just a wake-up call for me and said, okay, I can't actually do these two things at the same time. That the first 2 minutes of every visit, you know, it's a 15-minute visit, they're short. The first 2 minutes at least, the computer stays off. And I just listen and I'm just present with the patient, because that's what makes them feel heard and actually gives me a sense of purpose in terms of what I do.
I imagine you share that story with other doctors.
Yeah, I do. And it was a real wake-up call, and I'm incredibly grateful to that patient for having said that. We have programs at the medical center where we have trained coaches, usually psychologists, who will follow a physician around for a day and give them feedback about how they communicate with patients. This is not just in primary care. This is surgeons and anesthesiologists and emergency room doctors. I mean, people in every field of medicine increasingly has access, and even just spending a day giving feedback, these doctors are often really grateful, because they're often unaware of how what kind of work they need to do on their own communication skills.
I would think most people who want to perform at a high level would want to receive that kind of criticism. Mm. I don't know Elizabeth's doctor in this case, and I certainly don't want to extrapolate too much from one email, but I can just tell you that when listeners of this program are not happy with the host, I do want to hear. And by the way, they let me know.
Yeah.
But when you do 500 hours of live radio a year, you're going to say some pretty stupid things at times. And I want to hear when I have either crossed lines or offended or had that problem. And I think that makes anybody better when they hear that. So, Elizabeth, thank you for that. And good luck to you, not only in finding a doctor, but also in communicating with the doctor who made that remark. Let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back to more of your phone calls. So if you're on the line, Barb in Rochester, we're going to come to you. When we come back here, we've got some more of your emails to work through. You can call the program as we talk about doctor-patient communication. 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free. 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we sit down with Kenneth Morris, the great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass. He's in Rochester to launch a new project distributing millions of copies of Douglass's life story to young people across the country. We'll talk to him about his family's legacy and the current state of race relations. Then in our second hour, how can we reduce political dysfunction and incivility in our own political system? A former White House chief of staff discusses that question. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're just going to stay with your phone calls. A lot of phone calls from our listeners on this subject. Barb in Rochester is next. Go ahead, Barb. Hi, Barb. Can you
Hello.
Hear me? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I can. Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. Great. I wanted to speak about working through interpreters, specifically through sign language interpreters. I have a close friend who frequently goes to a local dental clinic here, and again and again, the interpreters are not available. This is through Strong. This is Elmwood Dental. And I'm saying it on purpose, the name of the place. I have no beef at all with the interpreters, and I don't think he does either. And no beef at all with the interpreting staff or the head of that department that handles interpreting services. However, And I understand that there's a huge number of people and that interpreters are running from one thing to another, and maybe they're in an emergency through Strong, which is right next to Elmo Dental. I get that. But, you know, when someone goes in for dental, I mean, that is very personal, like literally in your face, you know, and people are taking care of your teeth. They're causing you pain. They're communicating things that you're trying to understand. And he's not the only deaf friend who has expressed to me this concern that when he goes there, he never knows if he's going to have an interpreter, and he usually doesn't. Also, the other thing I wanted to mention was that, there are legal issues there because there is the Americans with Disability Act that requires that interpreters be available, especially if an organization, certainly with a doctor, but with an organization that hires more than whatever people. Anyway, Strong is way past that. So that's a legal issue, as well as a humanity issue. Lastly, I'm also aware from speaking with friends that at a doctor's appointment, doctors should know that if you're working with a deaf person, it may or may not, often not, but sometimes might, take a little more time. So budget that in. You might need it. There's a back and forth communication. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Barb. Thanks for the phone call. Some thoughts for the doctors? Rob?
Yeah. Only to acknowledge that's horrible. I mean, people need to be heard. And I wish your friend had an interpreter available. I think of simply talking about teeth, not a simple thing. I think of the conversations Ron and I are talking about advanced illness and making goals of care decisions and managing complicated symptoms. And to do that with limited language capacity, it's not fair. This is an inherent inequity. I imagine, Evan, you've had shows about that very thing here, and that's merited.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the call to budget more time and to make sure that is communicated and understood is really important. So thank you, Barb. Thank you for that phone call and a good reminder for everybody there. Let me get Julie in Fairport next. Go ahead, Julie.
Hi, I'm calling because I was just listening. I am privileged.
Rob's smiling.
The wonderful experience of working with Dr. Horowitz at the University of Rochester. I've been working with the medical students there for the last 10 years, and Dr. Horowitz has been a part of that all along, but more so in the last few years. And I just heard the caller saying we need more of this. And I just wanted to say that Dr. Horowitz is doing more of this. He's an amazing gift to the students. You know, Dr. Horowitz knows how much I love doing this work and how much part of why I love it so much is because watching him help these students with these difficult conversations is just really special, and it feels so valuable. And I always want to burst in the middle of it and just tell these students, you know, learn everything you can from this man right now, because it's so important. And I heard you say, Dr. Horowitz, I want that doctor to the caller who was just describing her wonderful doctor. Uh-huh. You are that doctor. You are teaching these students how to be that kind of doctor.
Well, Julie, can I ask you?
I just wanted to take a quick minute to say thank you.
Yeah, Julie, can I ask you a question, Julie?
Sure.
You're saying that when you observe him having difficult conversations with patients, you're hoping that others are understanding how to do that and sort of absorbing from it. So what's an example that you've seen from Rob that you think is a great way to model having these? And Rob is Rob is a very modest guy. Dr. Horowitz is not
that.
Here to be praised, but he's going to be praised. What do you see about having those difficult conversations that you think is the right way to do it?
Well, first of all, he's really good at helping everybody to realize that it's okay to say it the wrong way and to then, you know, regroup and think about what ways might be better. But he's just super forgiving and super generous, and he really helps. I mean, his enthusiasm and his genuine conviction and the value of this comes through so much. And I think that the students, I see them, they sit up straighter, they're paying attention, and they feel really engaged in a conversation and in a topic that is stressful and intimidating to them, especially because they're so young and they're thinking about having these difficult conversations oftentimes with people that are much their seniors. And I think Dr. Horowitz brings just this, instead of a fear and a dread around it, he brings this enthusiasm that makes you feel like you want to do it really well. You want to make sure people feel heard and valued.
Well, thank you, Julie. And Dr. Horowitz?
You know, I didn't plant you, in, but I would have if I had thought about it, Julie. Thank you for that. This is really touching. I should
welcome.
Say thank you for that. I want to acknowledge, so I'm sitting next to Ron Epstein, and Julie may not know this. The way I met Julie in this opportunity of training our medical students was through a program that Ron started many years before I inherited it. So Ron started this program of training our medical students to engage in difficult conversations, really, in, I don't know, 2001 maybe that was. I've been doing it the last few years. And there's more of this, not just tooting Rochester's horn, really around the country to help clinicians be more skillful, more willing. Thank you for that.
And it's not just students. There are efforts here that Rob is actually leading to train experienced practitioners, cardiologists, surgeons, kidney doctors, cancer doctors, how to have these conversations more effectively, even though they may have been in practice for 10, 20, 30 years, that they still have things to learn.
What is the most common mistake that you see even experienced practitioners make when they're having a hard conversation with the patient? Ron?
Providing information before listening.
Right.
That's the most common mistake, is to try to understand the patient before making yourself understood.
Okay, Rob?
Yeah, and very much related to that, responding to emotion with more data. We're really good at data. The students learn well how to manage complicated data. But sharing information when the patient's grief-stricken or angry or terrified about the future, that's a time to respond to emotion. That's not something that, unless you really focus on it, that comes naturally.
I want to talk a little bit about something that Ron has written about, dealing with a patient who perhaps has a serious illness, one that's going to require palliative care, and the patient says they don't want to know how much time perhaps they have left to live or what the prognosis would be specifically or how their illness may progress. Is there an ethical dilemma there? Especially if the family wants information, but the patient is telling you, if it's 3 months, don't tell me. I don't want to know. Or if whatever that is, I don't want that. Where do you draw those lines? And Dr. Epstein, I'll start with you on that.
If the patient has family members that they trust, this is much easier because I just would ask the patient permission, saying, would it be okay for me to talk with your family about this? And almost always the answer is yes. And I would ask, if there's a decision to be made, do you want to make it or would you prefer that your family make it about what treatments to do or what have you? And just, you can have those conversations without actually disclosing particular amounts of time. A second thing is to say, okay, I'm happy not to go there, but let's just think about, while hoping for the best, let's think about what would happen if the worst happens and what would you want under those circumstances, regardless of whether it happens tomorrow, next month, next year, or in 10 years. So in that sense, I get some guidance from the patient without having to disclose what is likely to happen and when it's likely to happen. Mm-hmm. It becomes a lot more complicated when patients are alone in the hospital without family members and there need to be difficult choices. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people in the hospital who either don't have family members who are alive or they're estranged from their families or are isolated in some way. And that becomes much, much more difficult. And sometimes the conversation is, we're at a choice point here, and we need your help. And sometimes patients can provide that help, and sometimes we just have to do the best we can.
Okay. Dr. Horowitz? So when it comes then to that moment when the family can they tell you, by the way, does the law allow a patient to say, you can't tell me and you can't tell my family? I mean, I guess I assume the answer is yes.
Yes, yeah. We can honor that. One, exactly what Ron said, plus ask. So I guess one of our primary bits of training is respond to emotion and ask first. And ask in response. And ask in response to emotion or denial. So if someone refuses to allow me to share information, my response is not necessarily to say, okay, we'll move on, but to inquire about that, to understand what's informing that. Because oftentimes if we engage in conversation, maybe right then, maybe over the next day or two or three, we'll get to a place where the patient trusts me, knows me, is willing to go there, is willing to believe it's possible that this information won't be as damaging as they anticipate, that it might actually help them through in some way. So to ask about that, because we might be able to disarm them just in that conversation and then go there. Sometimes we can't.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. This is Manan. Go ahead, Manan. Hi, Manan, are you there?
Hi, Anthony. This is Manan.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to mention that the medical and the healthcare system in America is highly expensive. It's $200 per doctor visit, $700 for the X-ray, $1,000 for an MRI. The whole medical care system is highly expensive, very complex, and very exhausting. And, you know, I get transportation, trying to get to the doctor, trying to get the medication, all of this. And I would like to mention there is a wonderful book by T.R. Reid. It's called The Healing of America. And the other one is The Tranquilizing of America. Secondly, I'd like to say that I met 77 and 68-year-old people who don't take any medications at all, and they're very healthy, and we should keep working on preventive health. Lastly, Evan, I am so glad that you're, you know, making this program today, and I want to thank Dr. Horowitz, because I would like to meet both of you someday and maybe get on the show and give a presentation on orthopedics in University of Rochester in 2014 for an entire year. I was fighting with them. I was there 4 years, and I stopped fighting and gave up because they had mistreated me, and so I'm
going
there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm losing the call there, just the audio quality. But thank you for the phone call. And I would just mention, if you want to add to your reading list that Manan gave you, put Attending on your list by Dr. Ron Epstein. Though, I mean, it sounds like the entire medical system has now read Attending, or should. What's the reception to the book been, by the way?
Very gratifying. And it's nice to know that you've made a difference.
Let me grab one more phone call as we get ready to lose the hour. This is Chris in Rochester. Go ahead, Chris.
Good afternoon. I'm wondering what steps, if that's the right word, would have to be taken to get, shall we say, non-traditional medicines or medications or treatments in a hospital if I were there and I had my wits about me. I've just had much better results with them personally.
What's an example?
Chelation therapy.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's an interesting question. Again, it kind of goes in line with what we heard earlier this hour about Chinese medicine, alternative medicines. Dr. Horowitz, what would it take if a patient comes to you with that?
I can tell you that certain complementary therapies one can bring in one's purse or briefcase. We like to know what people are using when they're in the hospital. That's what you're talking about. So during an admission, I like to know what substances are in their system, what they're using, what's in the room. Many of these will be allowed for sure. Others might be challenged, and I don't honestly know enough about chelation therapy to talk about what that would look like if you came in asking to provide that while you were hospitalized.
Can I assume if he's asking what would it take to see that presented as an option, what it would require is clinical testing and verification of efficacy.
For us to offer that in the hospital, oh, absolutely true, yes. For you to bring in your treatments, if maybe a different story.
All right, 30 seconds apiece as we get as we close the hour. Dr. Epstein, some closing thoughts for all of us to keep in mind next time we talk to our doctor about better communication.
Come prepared to talk about the things that are most important to you and start with those at the beginning of the visit. I think that that's probably the best piece of advice given the nature of medical practice now. So think to yourself before you see a doctor, if this were a successful visit, what would have happened? And then try to make that happen through the questions and issues that you bring up.
Mom, make a pyramid if you're listening back in Cleveland. Yeah. Start at the top with the most important. Don't work your way up with the small things. Okay.
You got it.
Good start. Dr. Horowitz.
And I guess while it should be your clinician's responsibility to assure that that happens, if it doesn't, and it often doesn't, help guide your clinician to do that very same thing. And if your clinician is being dominated by the point of the pyramid, help guide him down to the base.
All right, very good. Wonderful stuff this hour. So many listeners saying they would like to know, where do you practice and can you be their doctor? So the key is, these are two people in our community who are helping train others to communicate in this way. We all feel the pressure of time with our doctors and wanting to make it really count. And our thanks to Drs. Epstein and Horowitz. By the way, the event coming up 2 weeks from tonight, Tuesday, April 17th, 7 p.m. at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. Registration free, raom.org. Register, let them know you're coming. Rob, Ron, they're taking selfies now. Good job, guys. Hey, thank you. Always great to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Really a pleasure.
Rob Braden, Megan Mack behind the glass. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.